Let me get fired up on the computer here. There we go. It's been a while since I spoke before the feast, and if you might recall then, I began a series of sermons on the origins, as the title was Origins Part 1, 2, and 3, and I gave two parts of that, but it was on the related to the origin of everything. The origin of the universe was the focus of the first sermon. The origin of life itself was the focus of the second sermon, which I only got about halfway through. And so what I plan to do today is to cover the remainder of the origin of life as a proof of God. So before we do that, what I want to do is go back and give kind of a brief summary of what I covered in those first few sermons, since it's been a while since I gave that sermon, since some of you may not have caught those others. But going back to the mid-1800s, that's when Darwin's On the Origin of the Species came out, and the movement towards evolutionary theory really began to take sway. In terms of Darwin's theory, basically it was a couple of key aspects. The biggest part of that was that natural selection provides a theory on how complex life could have arisen. And of course, you know the background on evolution, that you start with something very simple and it gets more and more complicated, and finally we went from a single cell up to us, is kind of the theory. One thing that Darwin's theories did not offer was any explanation of the origin of the first life. Darwin's theory depends on life having already existed and then change is happening, but it does not in any way begin to explain first life. So setting aside all the issues with evolution, it is of no use when talking about the creation of life itself, the origin of life. And so as we looked into the origins in those last two sermons, at the beginning of the 20th century, things seemed kind of fixed. Science felt like they had a good handle on nature. You know, we talked about the beliefs was that time that the universe had always existed in an unchanging state, or that if it hadn't always existed, it had been created at a finite time, more or less like we see it today. So this was kind of the beliefs at the time, that basically the universe was a constant. Maybe it had been created, but maybe it had just been here for always. One of those two things were generally accepted. I think scientists at the time probably tended to lean towards the first one here. But and of course, the other thing, by that time, Darwin's theory of evolution was being accepted as a pretty reasonable scientific explanation for the growth of life from simple to complex. So that's kind of where we were around 1900 or so, the turn of that century. With Darwin's theory of evolution, religion and science, particularly scientific materialism, began to clash, you might say. Scientific materialism, the definition is that, or the thinking that goes with scientific materialism, is that life developed through strict mathematical laws of physics and blind chance. So everything can be explained by natural laws, and that God has nothing to do with it. That's basically what the theory is, whereas, of course, religious belief is that all life had a supernatural origin from God. Now, this whole thinking of science was turned upside down beginning in the 20s and 30s, 1920s, 1930s, but on in towards the 50s when more and more evidence came in that led to the Big Bang Theory as how the universe was created. And the Big Bang Theory says the universe was a point in a point, there was no space, and suddenly there was this huge bang, and the whole universe came from nothing. And this was tough for scientists to accept. And so they were very reluctant to accept this because it implied that if there was a point of where the universe was created, what created it? Or who created it? And science didn't want to drift into that kind of philosophical, religious question. I gave you some quotes. excuse me, I'll give you some of those again. At the time, the Big Bang Theory was beginning to grow in popularity. Albert Einstein said, "One cannot take such possibilities seriously." For example, physicist Arthur Eddington said, "The notion of a beginning is repugnant to me. I simply do not believe that the present order of things started off with a bang. The expanding universe is preposterous, incredible. It leaves me cold." They didn't want to accept it. The evidence since these quotes is even stronger, as we talked about in the first sermon where I focused more on the Big Bang Theory. A German physicist, Walter Nernst, said to deny the infinite duration of time would be to betray the very foundation of science. And it did turn science on its head. Cosmologist Andrea Lind said the non-stationary character of the Big Bang, based on the Friedman cosmological models, seems very unpleasant to many scientists in the 50s. And indeed it was. But as more and more evidence came in, science has generally accepted that indeed the universe was created. Arnold Penzias, he was one of the discoverers of the microwave afterglow, which was a very strong piece of scientific evidence about the Big Bang. But he said the easiest way to fit the observations with the least number of parameters was one in which the universe was created out of nothing in an instant and continues to expand. So that's kind of the general thinking today. But you can see the problem here. If the universe had a beginning, then life had a beginning. And so these things kind of go hand in hand. How do you explain the beginning? Now, we talked about and raised this question in one of my previous sermons, that have the 20th century discoveries undercut the Bible? No, actually, it kind of reinforces it, doesn't it? If the universe had an origin, who created it? If life had an origin, who or what created the first living organism? That's the question that science would like to answer in some way other than saying, well, God must have done it. But, of course, how does science explain the creation of a whole universe out of nothing? You know, how do you do that? In Psalm 102, verses 25 and 26, the Bible explains it. Of old you laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you will endure. Yes, they will all grow old, like a garment, like a cloak. You will change them, and they will be changed. Yeah, and we could point, and we did point to a number of scriptures that talked about the Bible very clearly, firmly, unequivocally, says, yes, God created the universe. And so it's interesting that now science pretty much agrees there was a creation. They still want to quibble about whether God did it or not, and we're going to look more into that in terms of the creation of life today. But last time we talked about some of the empirical facts that are ignored by materialists when it comes to life, and particularly humans. this enormous gulf that exists between humans and animals is a huge gulf. Animals simply aren't remotely like humans in so many ways. Humans have understanding. Humans have a concept of morality. Humans have free will, intelligence, are able to reason, have the concept of truth. All these things are completely foreign to any other species other than mankind. Where did that come from? We talked about abstract thought. We went through a lot of these different things in my second sermon. We talked about abstract thoughts and how only mankind can do that. Humans can think in terms of truth, possibility, virtue, all these kinds of things. We can think that way. No other species can. Thinking of a specific man is not abstract, but thinking of a term like masculinity is an abstract thought. We think mathematically in terms of numbers like pi. Pi, we could give an actual definition, is the ratio of the circumference of a circle divided by its diameter, 3.14159. I used to be able to give it more decimal places than that. But pi is more abstract than that. For some reason, it's like a constant associated with the physical world. As an engineer, I do, I mathematically model structural behavior. And it's uncanny how often pi pops up in those models. And in just about any kind of thing in the physical world that you model, that irrational number pi just pops up all the time. It's just there. It just comes out. It seems to be a part of nature. But that's all abstract thought. And of course, God is the ultimate in abstract thought. Being able to understand the idea that there is a God and rationally reason about the creation, all these kind of things, these are all abstract thoughts that we talked about last time. And God explains that in Isaiah 55, 8 through 9. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. So even though we're made in the image of God, we're not thinking like God yet. It'll be nice when that day comes and we're in that mode of thinking and understanding. But that's part of what we have in common with God. Abstract thought. And we talked a lot about some of these things. And we asked the question, is true religion anti-scientific? And I'll just repeat a couple of scriptures that I use to talk about that. In Ecclesiastes 7:25, Solomon wrote, I applied my heart to know, to search, to seek out wisdom and the reason of things, to know the wickedness of folly and even the foolishness and madness. Now, God challenges us to reason, to think. And that's what scientists do. They reason, they think, they prove things. And that's what God in the Bible teaches us in Acts 26:25. Paul, when he was defending himself before Festus, he said, I am not mad, most noble Festus, but speak the words of truth and reason. In other words, everything that we as Christians do is based on reason. In Acts 17:2, Paul, as his custom was, went into them and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures. And this whole idea of reasoning, abstract thought, understanding, proving things. The key scripture of 1 Thessalonians 5:21, test all things, hold fast what is good. That's what scientists do. These are the kind of things that science does, true science, when it is investigating physical phenomena. And so religion isn't anti-scientific, at least true religion isn't. A lot of false religions are very much anti-scientific. Now we get to the subject of scientific materialism. and the origin of life. The scientific materialism approach is pretty simple. Basically, they say nothing can exist that is not completely described by physics. So it can't be described by physics, it doesn't exist. Then natural science is the study of matter, so anything outside the realm of matter is outside scientific purview. So they basically dismiss right up front the whole idea of there's anything outside of nature. Now, this presents some problems, and we talked about a lot of these problems in the previous sermon, because such things as human consciousness, free will, and morality are outside any explanations related to science, to natural phenomena, physics, biology, things like that. It can't be explained. It simply can't be explained. So basically, scientific materialism is a circular reasoning. It's used to dismiss such mysteries by assuming they must be physical since materialism is true. So saying, well, this is true, therefore that can't be true. And so that's kind of circular reasoning. Doesn't really mean too much. And we went through a list of some fundamental scientific beliefs. So we got up to this point, and this is where I stopped in that last sermon. And this is where I'm going to pick up today. Let's look at some fundamental scientific beliefs. And talk about them a little bit. First of all, one belief is that life originated by a natural process, a sequence of events consistent with natural laws. I believe it happened in a way that can be explained without a creator, without God in the picture. Now, this is the fundamental belief, you might say. I'm going to list three fundamental beliefs of scientific materialism as it relates to the creation of life. This is the first one. Now, by saying this is a fundamental belief, they're ruling out anything like God. If it's not natural, it's rejected out of hand and not even considered. Now, I got interested in where science was in looking at the creation of life, particularly the creation of first life, and how they tried to explain that. And even went to the point of ordering a college course about the origins of life. It was like 36 half-hour lectures. Went through that whole thing, wanting to know what are they saying? You know, what's the other side saying, you might say? What kind of evidence are they holding up? And I'm going to talk about that quite a bit in the rest of this sermon. But I'll preface saying, they're not saying much. The evidence is really not there. And I'll show you what I learned from that as we go through this. But this is one of the fundamental beliefs, that it had to be natural laws that did it. And then the second fundamental belief of scientific materialism, at least as it relates to creation of life, is that life has originated in the cosmos multiple times. Now, why is this an important fundamental belief? Well, very simply, it's important because if it only happened once, ever, if life only had its origin once here and nowhere else in the entire universe, then how do you call that a natural phenomenon? If it only happened once. Natural phenomena are something that's built into the system. It occurs over and over again. And so, if you can find another solar system that has life, you can say, see, it happens over and over. It must be a natural phenomenon. And so that leads to some of the almost desperation that you see in modern times, particularly in the era of space exploration. Wanting to find some hint, some clue of life outside of us. Now, hopefully Mars, kind of close by, but independent, maybe if it involved came independently of life on Earth, if another solar system or somewhere else, and another star system, boy, if they could find life there, they see, it's it's nature, because this happens every other place, and it's probably happening, and they still say that, oh, it's probably happened millions of times, because there's billions and billions of star systems out there, and there's got to be a lot of Earths out there, and so there's probably life in a lot of places. Interestingly, no hint of any has been found. But if it only happened that once, that kind of destroys the whole idea that it's a natural phenomenon. And then the third thing is, and this is the faith, where faith comes in, it's only a matter of time until science discovers how life occurred. So, those are the fundamental beliefs. And you start with that, that kind of rules out God right from the beginning. And as I was preparing this sermon, I subscribed to some technical magazines and things of that nature. And one came across my computer that really grabbed my attention, and I'll show it to you here. Let's see. I'm going to see if my little laser pointer works on this thing, or whether I've got to use the one on my hand. Hold on just a second. Let me bring it up. Yeah, there it is. It works. Okay. I've got a nice little laser pointer I can use. But see this area right here? And that one right up there, that's the issue that that we're talking about in terms of this headline that came across from Space Magazine. And the headline, or the introductory sentence read that scientists have found a strange structure resembling a microbial cell inside a Martian meteorite. But they're not claiming that it's evidence of life. Does that sound kind of strange to you to read a sentence like that? You know, it just doesn't sound quite right, does it? Now, let me go and show you what they determine. First of all, this meteorite fell to Earth in Egypt in 1911. Now, don't ask me to explain to you how they know it came from Mars. But they think it did. You know, yeah, there are ways to kind of to measure the kind of materials that Mars is made out of. And apparently these compared to it. And so they've made this conclusion that that meteorite did somehow come from Mars. But we'll set that aside for a minute. But I want to give you just a couple of other quotes from the article. One was, "We conclude that the most reasonable explanation for its origin is that it formed through abiotic processes," meaning that it wasn't biology that created that. It was not a living organism that created that. It was formed by something else, that living organisms were not involved. That's their explanation. That's the reasonable conclusion. But then they go on, and they write this a little bit later in the article, "But this supposition doesn't rule out the possibility that Martian life forms had something to do with the structure." Interesting, isn't it? Here's another quote from that article. "However, it could have been formed directly by microorganisms, or it could trap organic material that came from elsewhere." Now, see, they say, okay, the only reasonable conclusion is this has nothing to do with any kind of organism. However, maybe, it might, it's possible. And every time you see a headline, and you'll see a lot of them in the next year probably, because you got all these space things out there that's wandering around Mars, and they're going around to landing on comets and doing all kinds of stuff, and these telescopes out there can see further and further. And every time you see an article about them, one thing that it almost always says, "We hope to discover the secret of life, how life began." It always says something like that. So you have to be very careful about the kind of terms that you read, because they can be very speculative. Now, One of the things that these researchers that are looking into the origin of life, origin of first life, one of the things that they like to talk about is emergence. Emergence. That now this is kind of a nice sounding word that really means it just happened. They call it emergence. How you have these inert chemicals, and somehow through the creation of the earth and its formation and its cooling and all these things that went on, and somewhere along the way, life just kind of emerged. And so they're big on emergence. And so, but don't be fooled by that. Just means it just happened. It's no big deal there. And see, and there's a problem here, and that is that the simplest single-cell organisms are incredibly complex, and there is no simple to complex. It simply doesn't exist in living organisms. There is no simple. They're all complex, and you know it kind of immediately defeats the idea that life's emerged. But a lot of scientists will stick to that. You know, from a single cell amoeba to human cells, they all are very similar in structure. Amoeba, single cell amoeba, is not any appreciable way different from the cells in your own body. They're that complex. All have the same ingredients: sugars, amino acids, nucleic acids, and hydrocarbons. That's what life is composed of, whether it's a single cell organism or whether it's you. Well, we all look the same there, and that under that microscope when they look at the cells. Every living cell has the exact same chemical process of DNA and RNA to store genetic material. All of them do. And likewise, all share the exact same process for using this information to build proteins. Proteins, of course, is the source of life. So there is no simple. They're all complex. Now, I suspect probably a number of you might have seen the Nova series on PBS. Neil deGrasse Tyson is a physicist who was the basically created that. He's the commentator on that, and it was talking about origins. That was the name of it, origins. And it was talking about the origin of the universe, the origin of life. It was talking about all this stuff, and it was a series. And then later on, I think it came out, maybe Fox produced one similar to that, that related into, tied into that. But Tyson and his co-author, Donald Goldsmith, they wrote a book based on the series called Origins. And I got the book. I was interested in seeing what they had to say since I was preparing this sermon at the time. And so I looked up, they had a chapter of about 20 or 30 pages on the origin of life. And here's two quotes from that chapter. The origin of life on Earth remains locked in murky uncertainty. And then a few paragraphs later, the crucial question of how life actually began on Earth, either once or many times over, has no good answer. Now, if it has no good answer, the implication is that there must be some bad answers out there. But there's no good ones. So I thought that was interesting to read that. And I took this, like I said, about 15 or 20 pages that basically addresses this. So I just scanned through that little section looking for keywords, like I was talking to you before about keywords. And what I found that over and over again, I found certain phrases used in this section, like, many believe. It's nice to know scientists have faith, isn't it? Might have been triggered. Or, life might have begun. Or, might have arisen. or many speculate. Over and over again, you see these kind of terms. As soon as you see one of those phrases, something should click in your mind. Watch out, they're trying to sell you something. Okay? All right, now let's get into the origin of life theories and their problems. I'm going to take you through some of the key concepts of origin of life ideas and why, when you really look at them, they don't make any sense. First of all, this is has kind of a prominent place in theories related to the origin of first life, and that is a series of chemical reactions, probably a very long and intermittent sequence, resulted in the first life. Of course, after millions and millions and maybe billions of years, it took. Okay, so what they're saying, this is kind of that emergence idea. They're saying, okay, got all these chemicals, and chemicals kind of like to join together and mix together and produce other compounds and so forth. Some do, some don't. You know, oil and water, they don't mix very well, do they? But a lot of things, you mix them up, they produce new compounds. So the idea is that you have all these chemicals lying around in the atmosphere, on the earth, under the water, different places, and a couple of them come together, maybe in a mud puddle somewhere, and form a new compound that sits around. A million years later, some other chemical joins in, makes a new compound, and then another million years, another element happens to pop in and makes another, and this goes on and on for billions of years. And at some point, life happened. Well, yeah, that's not the way nature works. What physical laws would cause that to happen? Matter of fact, that this whole idea violates the second law of thermodynamics. Systems tend to become disordered over time, not more ordered. So there's a problem there. But then to get around all these kind of objections that you just don't see anything like that in nature, some speculate, well, there must be a missing law of nature. And once we find this missing law, then it'll all be clear. Entirely speculative. All right, let's look at this idea of evolved, that life evolved through a series of... And that's kind of like emergence, but this is getting more kind of tying into evolutionary theory. That, yeah, something happened, these chemicals happened, somehow they evolved, and somewhere along the way they actually became living organisms. The problem is, all known living forms are complex. There's no... You can't point and say, yeah, here's a simple one, and then this one got more complex, and this one got... There's nothing like that. They don't exist. Interestingly enough, they're all extremely complex. I'm going to show you a few examples just how complex they are in a minute here. And that's the big question. If this occurred over billions of years, where are the surviving intermediate molecules? You know, if some molecules join together and more join together, and over millions of years, finally life, shouldn't there be a whole history in the fossil record of those that didn't make it? There's nothing. It simply doesn't exist. None have ever been discovered. Nada. Not one. Okay. Let's look at it. Another aspect of this. That the first life forms were something much simpler than a single cell, because single cells today are too complex. Now here's an admission from science that the cells of the simplest organisms are too complex to say, yeah, it started there. And so the idea is that there must be some earlier ones that weren't so complex. The problem is that science has found fossil organisms, at least by carbon dating, go back 3 billion years. So it goes back a pretty good ways. And they're all complex. They're not simpler. They can't find any. And science admits they are simply too advanced to suggest that they were the simpler life forms. And so there's nothing there. There's not a clue about this. No evidence of simple to complex. And, you know, I guess I was a little surprised in going through all this material and seeing that nothing, it's all complex. There simply is no simple. Now, let's talk about the thing that for the last 50, 60 years, scientific materialists have hung their hat on to say, this shows the way. It's called the Miller-Urey experiments. You might have heard of the Miller-Urey experiments. They purportedly show how life began. Let me summarize. The whole idea was that 3-4 billion years ago, the Earth was in a chaotic state, and the atmosphere was very different. We couldn't live in that kind of atmosphere, and there's a lot of debate of whether even the assumptions of what kind of atmosphere existed then was in fact existed. But anyway, this was the assumption, that there was a very different world then, and what happened is that there was the atmosphere was primarily hydrogen, methane, and ammonia. You could clean out your sinuses and stuff if you were breathing it, but I don't think we could have survived in that atmosphere, if indeed it ever existed. But that's the speculation, that that was the kind of atmosphere. And so what Miller and Urey did was they mixed these components with water vapor, heated it, and applied an electric spark to see what they got. And what they got was an amino acid. All right, here I've got a diagram that shows the whole scheme of how they set this up schematically. You know, here's some water sitting right here, and they apply a heat source and boil the water, and so the gas heads on up this little line here, and as the water vapor goes up that way, they insert the ammonia, the methane, the hydrogen in gaseous form, and they all mix together, and they keep traveling up here together. Now you've got that atmosphere that presumably existed 4 billion years ago, and so it's forced down into this area where there are these things are wired up with a gap here, and the electric current is shot across, creating a spark across that gap to simulate lightning. And then the gas is forced on down through here. As it goes through this tube, it's surrounded by a condenser, which cools it down, cools the gas, turns it into liquids or solids, and it falls on down and ends up in the bottom, right down here. That was the experiment. And it produced an amino acid. Okay? Now the what people are saying, see, that shows an amino acid could be produced, therefore we know how life was created. Well, there's some problems with that. They did produce an amino acid, and following this, people tried similar types of experiments, and they were able to produce a few amino acids. There are 20 amino acids in living cells, 20 of them. And they were able to produce a couple. But basically, all this experiment shows was that if you're clever, you can design experiments to create amino acids. And every single amino acid can be created in laboratories by different methods. I mean, you can create them. Well, they're trying to prove, well, yeah, you can create it in what might have been the natural environment then. And again, that's heavily debated. But this is the only evidence that I found that remotely points to anything that has to do with the creation of life. And all I was talking about is, yeah, it might be possible to create an amino acid or two. That's it. That's the evidence. It's just not much there. Now, all through this, one natural law is totally and completely ignored. The law of biogenesis, that life comes only from life. Nobody, no scientists will argue that, because they can't produce a single example of where life came from anything other than life. It's a fact. It's not a theory. It's a fact. It's never happened once. It's consistent with the Bible. Yeah, that's what the Bible says. Genesis 1:26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, the cattle, over all the earth," so forth. God says, "I did it." And not only that, He says, "I did it in my likeness." Not like an animal, but like God, is the way humans were made. In Psalm 36, verse 9, "For with you is the fountain of life. In your light we see light." God is the fountain of life. So life does only come from life. In this case, spiritual life. So where does science and religion differ? Really, in a lot of ways, not much. It's kind of along the edges in many cases. These are kind of some scientific conclusions here. Biology has been shown to be reducible to chemistry and physics. And basically, there's no disagreement there. It's a physical thing. And it's controlled by physical laws. There's not much argument with that. Man appears to physically be much like an animal. All right, the Bible kind of confirms that, at least to a certain extent. Just from a physical viewpoint, looking at the biology, there's not much difference. Not much difference in the cells, reproduction, all kinds of things, not much difference. But as Ecclesiastes 3, verses 18 and 19, "I said in my heart concerning the conditions of the sons of man, God tests them, that they may see that they themselves are like animals. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to animals. For one thing befalls them, as one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over the animals, for all is vanity." So there's not really much disagreement there that man is a physical thing, much like an animal. And like I say, it's in the kind of periphery there. Once we get away from the physical and get into the spiritual, then things change. There's a correspondence between physical events in the brain and mental processes. There's not so much study in the brain. If you're trying to do something mathematical, certain parts of your brain starts lighting up, those neurons. If you're doing something like listening to music, another part of the brain lights up. There's some correspondence there. There's no argument between science and religion on any of that. Computers have shown that machines can perform mental tasks. That chess-playing machine, I talked about that a lot in a previous sermon, but they're programmed. They don't really think. They're programmed to, like a decision tree, but they're not really thinking. But they can do things. What happens in the physical world is determined by physics. And in general, I think most people would agree with that. In the physical realm. The problem, as we mentioned before, and the main area of disagreement falls into things like intellect, free will, morality, intelligence, all these kinds of things, virtue, truth, all these kinds of things fall outside the physical realm. And science has a great deal of difficulty even beginning to deal with that. So now a few questions here. Let's get to the latter part of the sermon. Always a good question to ask to start off with: which came first, the chicken or the egg? Now, if you're a scientific materialist, you'd probably say the egg. And your reasoning might go something like this. You'd say, there were a long series of chemical reactions, and mutations occurred, and it led from simple organisms to more complex organisms. And at some point, a thing that slightly resembled a chicken occurred. Some egg, it hatched out and didn't look like his mother and father because a mutation occurred, and it looked a little bit more like a chicken than his parents did. And maybe it took billions of years, but at some point a prototype chicken came along. Now, this is the scientific materialist argument. So you've got this prototype chicken. We'll call it proto chicken. Okay, so proto chicken comes along, and maybe it has a little natural, maybe he's got a, maybe he's starting to have a little bit of a beak, and that gives him a competitive advantage among his other chickens. And so he starts mating with these previous proto chickens, and somewhere along the way, maybe a million years down the line, there's another mutation occurs between these proto chickens and a different proto chicken that now looks a little bit more like a chicken. And so it gets along well, it flourishes, it produces offspring, they mate with the previous proto chickens. Another million years later, there's another mutation. This thing gradually takes the shape of a chicken. So you've got these proto chickens that went over a billion years, at first looked nothing like a chicken, but finally that last mutation, an egg was laid, and there was a mutation that occurred, and what happened? Out came the first real chicken. No more proto chickens, but an actual chicken. Now, of course, that chicken had to mate with the proto chickens because he was the only one. But apparently, his genes were so dominant that more real chickens produced that began to mate. And pretty soon, all the proto chickens were gone, and we cannot find a single one that existed over billions of years, but there's plenty of chickens out there. See, that would be scientific materialist arguments about which came first, the chicken or the egg. So they'd probably say the egg. I think we have to, is that really the right question to ask? You know, when it comes to the origin of life, another good question to ask is which is more credible? That God created life, or that it just emerged or just happened? You know, that's pretty weak when scientists say, well, it just kind of happened. We have no idea why. It's kind of murky. But we think we'll find out one day, as opposed to God creating. You know, so when you get into this circular reasoning, I mentioned this a little earlier. All emergent systems display complexity, is the idea. They're all complex, and since the fundamental assumption is that initially they weren't, then they must have emerged from simple systems, even if we can't find any of them. See this kind of circular reasoning that takes place. Now, this is scientists talking here, and people that study this stuff and looking for evidence. Now, so the conclusion of the materialist is eventually a natural law will be discovered to explain everything. That's kind of their hope. So let's go back to which came first and ask this question. Which came first, the cell wall or the cell structure within? Which came first, the cell wall or the cell structure within? A pretty valid question. You know, all cells have membranes, and they're there for a specific reason. They're basically fatty molecules called lipids, and they keep the outside out and the inside in. And typically, these membranes are these cells have water on the outside and water on the inside, but the water's different. You know, it may be less salinity, more so forth, different chemicals and so forth in that water, but they're different, and so they can't be separated. You know, the cell has got to have exactly the right kind of liquid in there. So these membranes have to keep them separated, and so the way this happens is that cell membranes, the walls of a cell, are double layered. Kind of interesting. They're double layered, and the reason for this is that water is an effective solvent. Water is polar, means has a positive side and a negative side, and so it can dissolve things. And so you have to have something that water won't mess with. To keep the cell from being torn apart, basically. So the cell walls need a barrier that is compatible with water, you might say, on the outside, but impervious, so it can't pass through the walls. But it has to be compatible so it won't get torn apart, dissolve. So it's kind of a messy thing there. And yet at the same time, nutrients have to be passed in and out of the cell, waste and so forth. It's complicated. Like they say, life is complicated. All right, well, here's a little sketch of how this emerged. Yeah, right. Basically, there's these phospholipids. And the characteristics of these phospholipids, they have a polar head, and that's made up of a group of phosphates, a compound. And these phosphates tend to line up in a single layer. That's the way they're made, so that they just line up all together, like they're shown here, into a surface. But they have legs. And these legs, they're a molecule of hydrocarbon chains that are dangling down. And these heads of these things are polar. You know, so they have a positive and negative side. Water has a positive and negative side. So the positive and negative will match up, and so they won't try to pull each other apart. So it's compatible to water on the outside. But these hydrocarbon legs, they aren't. And so water is repelled by that. But since there's water on the outside, water on the inside, you need a double layer with the legs facing each other. And so that's the way it's built. I wonder how that could have just emerged or just kind of happened. Let me show you another sketch here that adds a little bit more to it. Here you see all those little phospholipids. And you see there's some proteins cutting through the cell wall. And these transport proteins are to allow things to come in and out in a controlled way. You know? And so these protein receptors regulate the flow of molecules in and out. The inner controls the energy in the cell. So it's all set up. Now, so this is the unanswerable question from science. How could a cell exist unless this cell wall was perfect from the get-go? How could it exist unless it was perfect from the get-go? Doesn't make any sense. I mean, it has to, all the things have to be there. And of course, they've never found anything less than this. And so, you ask the question, which came first, the cell wall or the cell structure within? About the only logical answer that you can come up with is neither came first. It must have happened simultaneously. Now, this thing that's so complex as this, it had to have everything in place from the beginning or the cell would not survive. You know, and that's just the cell wall. You know, there's so much inside a cell that we could spend a lot of time talking about a lot of details. But this is just one example here of things that had to be perfect from the beginning. Both had to occur simultaneously. There's no other logical conclusion. That's how God said it happened. He said, "Yeah, I made it. That's the way I did it." Now, here's an even broader question, and this is the one when I talked about taking that course. They spent a lot of time on this because this is a big debate in the origins of life scientific studies. Which came first, genetics or metabolism? All right, let me explain a little bit. Genetics. Here we're talking about passing on characteristics to the next cell as the cells divide, expand, that sort of thing. Passing on characteristics not only eventually to the next generation, but it stores genetic information and copies that information. All right, it's a data retrieval kind of system, genetics. Metabolism is what makes the body work. And it basically is proteins, those little protein machines that make the cell work, make the whole body work. Okay, so you have metabolism. You know, these cells are growing, expanding, creating proteins that are needed for the body, all these kinds of things, taking in food, processing food, creating, you know, the whole business. That's metabolism. Okay, which came first? That's the big question. Now, back in the middle of the last century, 60s, maybe something like that, of 1960 or so, Watson and Crick came up with the famous double helix structure for the DNA. You know, DNA is a very fundamental part of every cell of any life form. Deoxyribonucleic acid, close as I can do for it. But it's this spiral double helix kind of thing that they discovered, and it's incredibly complex. I'm going to take a couple of minutes just to talk about it. From a genetics viewpoint, basically the DNA leads to RNA, which is kind of similar to the DNA, which leads to proteins. That's the process, okay? Now let's blow this thing up a little bit and talk about what's in this double helix. You know, the sides are formed by molecules of sugar, deoxyribose, and phosphate group compounds. So that's the spiral sides. But then these rungs, the things that cross between the two spirals, are four bases. Adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine, and they're almost always referred to by their first letters A, C, G, and T. Okay, so that's what's there. And A is always linked to T, and C is always linked to G, another little thing there. Who knows why? But basically, you have these four things. Let's call them letters, because they're basically it's an alphabet. We can look at it at least as an alphabet that consists of only four letters. Now, if you have an alphabet of four letters, could we take the English language and all the words in the English language? Could we convert that into a language that only used four letters and still have all the words? Would that be possible? What do you think? Could you take just four letters and create every single word in the English language? Yeah, you could. The problem would be some of those words would get very, very long. Because you got four letters and you got a repeating pattern, this, because every one has to be different. But if you string them out, you know, if a word had 500 letters, say, you know, you could do it. You could do it. Well, that's kind of what's going on inside of us. That's what's going on. Because there's no limit to the length of these strands, and they alternate with the A, C, G. You know, they're just in some kind of pattern. And there's no limit to the things. And so what's happening is that these strings of these four letters encode a message. And that's how information is passed on from the cell. Certain short strands are called genes, and they carry the code for the 20 amino acids that are produced. Now, each three letters in a sequence forms words, or the technical term, codons. And each codon represents one of the 20 amino acids. Now, a long string, say between 100 and 500 of these amino acids, when folded together in exactly the right shape, produces a protein. Okay. So that's how it all is. Yeah, it's simple, right? Okay, the proteins are these little tiny machines inside us that carry on all the functions of life. Now, the interesting thing about it is there's over 100,000 different proteins in the human body. It's a lot, isn't it? Okay, so that, but all that has to be programmed into our DNA. So what happens is the information to construct these proteins, so this is in the DNA language, a length of DNA, a gene, contains this information. When a particular protein is needed, a particular gene region is read by some other protein machines, to use the simple term. They get the recipe they needed to make the protein. And then the recipe is transcribed by another type of molecule similar in form to the DNA, it's an RNA. And then the information on the RNA molecule is transferred in a proper sequence of amino acids. And that's how they sequence the amino acids in a proper way to tell it, okay, here's how we want this thing made. And it goes into another little protein device or machine called a ribosome. And then finally, the assembly of the amino acids are exactly folded together, and it produces a protein, three-dimensional. You know, here's another little sketch that shows the DNA has separated, and the messenger RNA has attached itself to get this right sequence, and then it's going to transfer that information on. Let's look at it from another viewpoint. Here's the cell over here. Here's the nucleus of the cell. That's where all the chromosomes are. Here's one of those chromosomes, and inside those chromosomes, the spiral DNA. And then within that spiral DNA are these nucleosomes. They kind of get balled up, but at certain points they get unwound, and they come down, and inside of those are histone proteins. And, let's go a little bit further here. That just gives you a general idea, but recent discoveries show that there's a sophisticated genetic control system called the epigenome. So back in Washington Crick, they thought they had solved it. They had it all. They would just had the tip of the iceberg. Because now they've discovered that this epigenome with four elements, they call them tags. One of these tags is a methyl tag, which is associated with health. And it can turn on and turn off genes. And if it turns on the wrong gene, it might trigger cancer. And so if they can figure out how to turn these things on and off properly, they could turn off one that was accidentally turned on that causes cancer, they could turn it off. And so science is hoping that one day, through gene therapy, they may be able to control things like cancer. So that's one of the tags. Another tag is the acetyl tag, and it can make proteins available or unavailable. There's some other group of tags, which they don't even know what they are, but they know they're there. And then there's a tag that gives a cell a shape and a stability of form and so forth. There are all these things there. And then they can increase, these tags can silence or activate certain genes. Now, here's another nice little schematic here. Here's our friend the chromosome, and here a breakdown of the DNA. And here are some of those things we were talking about, those little balls, and they're kind of bundled up. And if you look right in here, they're kind of highlighted in yellow. There's a gene that's kind of hidden. It can't be reached. But these little histones have tails sticking out of them. And these tags come and attach themselves to those tails and can cause them to unwind and expose this gene. And then that gene is activated. Incredibly complex going on here. Much more incredible than Watson and Crick ever envisioned when they first determined what was going on here. All right, so this brings us to some unanswered questions related to genetics. Like, how does a cell know when to divide? What triggers it? I mean, you know, we grow to a certain size. How do we get from a baby to an adult? More cells are added to our body, but something happens and we stop growing because the cells stop. At least certain cells stop and don't keep breaking up and creating more. We stop at some point. How does it know that? You know, how do cells know to become one type of cell, not another? they all start out looking pretty much the same. Each cell has exactly the same DNA. How do they know how to specialize? How do cells know to use some of the information in the DNA molecule to build specific proteins but not other? How do they know? You know, can a complex organism like this just happen? Can it happen? We have not reached the point where we really understand genetics. We haven't reached it. We don't understand all the details of what goes on in all this stuff. But here, and that's just a part of the intricacy of a single human cell. And we're still learning. You know, you combine it all together. It's so complex, it's hard to imagine that we'll ever figure out exactly how all of it works. You know, but the thing is, all you have to do is pull the plug on one little piece, and the whole cell collapses and dies. You know, that's kind of what happens when you get sick and so forth, is it attacks the cells. Maybe killing cells that are important, that sort of thing. But one little piece is all you need to remove. And so there's no natural explanation as to how all this interdependence could have possibly have gradually occurred. And science wants to convince us, but it happened. It just happened. And on top of that, there's this dilemma that goes back to my question about which came first, genetics or metabolism. Because, see, here's the problem. Living cells, anything, are composed of DNA, RNA, proteins. They have to have them. Okay? DNA and RNA cannot be made without proteins. Okay? So you've got to have DNA and RNA. If it's made, it's got to be from proteins. The problem is, it's DNA and RNA that make the proteins. See the problem? So which came first? The metabolism of the proteins or the DNA of genetics? There's only one answer when it boils down to it. They all had to happen together. Genetics or metabolism? Remember, no evidence of any simpler cells have ever been found. It was interesting, and Stephen Barr wrote a book titled Modern Physics and Ancient Faith, and he was looking at a lot of this kind of evidence and talking about these things, but he quoted a study that was done and where they said, okay, what's the minimum you'd need to have an operating cell of all this stuff? And he says, he's quoting them, he says, it appears that a one-celled organism needs to have quite an elaborate structure involving dozens of different proteins, a genetic code containing at least 250 genes, many tens of thousands of bits of information. For chemicals to combine in random ways in a primordial soup to produce a strand of DNA and RNA containing such a huge amount of genetic information would be as hard as for a monkey to accidentally type an epic poem. The minimum requirements of a single cell are so great that for it to accidentally happen, it just doesn't. You know, going back to Darwin, Darwin says, I believe what I've got. If you want to disprove it, here's the test. And he wrote in his book, he said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organism existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. In other words, what he's saying is, prove it's not true. Prove it's not possible. You know, now, shouldn't the question really be that to prove that something, rather than to prove something is not possible, is to prove that something did occur? See, Darwin's saying, prove it's not possible. The question should be, prove that it's possible or prove that it occurred. See, so that's the kind of approach of science. Prove it didn't happen this way, although I have no evidence that it did. Doesn't make much sense, does it? All right, so let's get into some conclusions here as we wrap this up here. The natural laws of physics cannot explain the origin of life. It simply cannot. There's no evidence. None at all. Natural selection can't, because natural selection begins with life. That can't explain it. Darwin's theories can't. So the only other chance is it just happened. What are the odds of it just happening? Not much. But of course, there is God. The alternative that seemingly most scientists do not like to consider. Look at a few passages here. Genesis 1, 26 and 27. I think we've read this already, that God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness." We're made like God. He did it. In John 1, 1 through 3, "In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him, and without Him nothing was made that was made." The Bible so clearly says God did it. Psalm 104, verses 24 and 30. "O Lord, how manifold are your works, and wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your possessions." Then in verse 30, "You sent forth your spirit, they are created, and you renewed the face of the earth." Or in Colossians 1:16, "For by him, Jesus, all things were created that are in the heaven and that are on the earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions, principalities or powers. All things were created through him and for him." Now let's look at John 6, verses 60 through 66 here. Therefore, he said some hard things. Jesus did at this time. He really started talking spiritual things, and they didn't get it. "And therefore, many of his disciples, when they heard this, said, 'This is a hard saying. Who can understand it?' And when Jesus knew in himself that his disciples complained about this, he said to them, 'Does this offend you? What then if you should see the Son of Man ascend where he was before?'" So he raises that question. But then he says this that I've highlighted here. "It is the Spirit who gives life." It's the Spirit who gives life. The flesh profits nothing. "The words that I speak to you are spirit, and they are life." Okay, now, you know, I raised that question. What makes us different from the animals? The processes look the same biologically. But we're different. We're so incredibly different. Why? Why? Let's continue this reading this section here. "But there are some of you who do not believe, for Jesus knew from the beginning who they were and who did not believe and who would betray him. And he said, 'Therefore, I have said to you that no one can come to me unless it has been granted to him by my Father.' From that time, many of his disciples went back and walked with him no more." So he was talking spiritual, but he was also talking physical there. And this brings up the question. Since biologically, animals and humans, they seem to be just the same. Cells are similar. Everything's similar. Why such a big difference? You know, why? How did it happen? You know, think about it. Let's look at the creation of you. How did you start? You started as a single cell. Apart from the mother, apart from your father, formed a single cell. Everything about you was in that single cell. You were there. Complete and total definition of you was in a single cell. And the first day of that creation of that single cell, it divided in two and produced two. And a day later, they divided again, and you are four cells. And a day later, they divided again, and you are eight cells. And by day five, the division had taken the point that these cells began to clump together in a way that minusculely began to form you as a human being. After about 5 days, Think about that. Your ability to reason, to think abstractly, to speak, to imagine, to have free will. It was all there in that one cell. It was all there. As incredible as it seems. And then, of course, what happened? 9 months later, that little thing by 8 weeks began to look, well, I wouldn't say it looked like a human, but it was beginning to take shape. And a little over, a little over nine months, you were born. And God likes to use this analogy of human birth, being begotten and growing in the womb, and eventually you're born. And He likes to compare that spiritually. But what happened? There's a question here of something. Where does humanness come from? Biologically, you can't find it. Is there a human tag that somehow formed somewhere? Don't think so. Look at 1 Corinthians 2 and verses 9 through 11. But it is written, eyes not seen, nor ear heard, nor have entered into the heart of man, the things which God has prepared for those who love Him. But God has revealed them to us through His Spirit. For this Spirit searches all things, just the deep things of God. And then this verse is popped in there. It's one of the few places we get a hint of what is going on biologically. For what man knows the things of a man except the spirit of man which is in him? Did the spirit of man, was that in that first cell? I don't know. But my guess is it was. From the very beginning, the difference between us and an animal was there was something there, the spirit of man, that was placed in by God into that cell. And it made all the difference in the world. Even so, no one knows the things of God except for the Spirit of God. Yes, there's a Spirit of God, there's a Spirit in man. They're not the same things. But it's what distinguishes us and what made us different from the animals. Now, Acts 17 and verse 25 through 28. Nor is he worshipped with men's hands, as though he... Now, this is Paul speaking at Mars Hill when they had all those idols and they had one to the unknown God. That's the background here. And so he's talking about the unknown God that he's explaining to him. And he says, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell in all the faces of the earth. And he has determined their preordained times and boundaries of their dwellings so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for Him and find Him, though He is not far from each of us. For in Him we live and move and have our being. It's God. And He got something in us that made us in His image, not like an animal. The spirit in man. You know, that's the physical thing. And then he uses that to compare to God's spirit. Just like we're begotten, we grow in the womb, and we're finally born physically. We're begotten spiritually. We grow in the womb of this physical life, and at some point we will be begotten spiritually. Look at Psalm 104, verses 28 to 30. As our concluding scripture here. What you give them, they gather in. You open your hand, they are filled with good. You hide your face, they are troubled. You take away their breath, they die and return to their dust. You send forth your spirit, and they are created. You renew the face of the earth. Now, we could take this two ways. We could take this of the embedding of the spirit of man at birth, but also God's Holy Spirit at our spiritual conception. Now, both happen. One physical, the other spiritual. And we're in the process of that spiritual birth, having experienced that physical birth, most of us, many, many years ago. But you see the idea. Our creation physically is just a metaphor for our spiritual birth that is to come. That's why we're different from the animals. God made us different. That's what science can't see. Now, just like there's a distinction between us and the animals physically, isn't there going to be a distinction between us and other spirit beings in God's kingdom? We are going to be the sons of God. There will be other spirit beings, angels. They're different. There's going to be that kind of gap because they're different. That's the way God works. That's the way He operates. That's the way He creates. And if you look at the science, how can you conclude that possibly anything other than the great Creator God made man and made the universe and made everything that goes with it, just as the Bible says?